Very few people get a straight line to happiness. In the case of our guest this hour, it was a very wavy line. Crooked, actually, is the term she uses. Heather Harpum fell in love with a man who did not want kids, got pregnant, broke up with the man, had a child, found out she had serious medical issues, talked it over with the father. Well, it gets complicated. That should be clear by now. The details are contained in a memoir called The Crooked Little Road to Semi-Ever After. That's the subtitle. Happiness is the title of the book. Heather Harpum is a playwright, solo performance artist, essayist, and fiction writer. She teaches at Sarah Lawrence College and the State University of New York at Purchase, both north of New York City. Her stage performances include a theatrical performance of the material in her book, also called Happiness. Heather Harpum, thanks for joining us today on The Exchange.
Thanks so much for having me.
So I know this is a bit in the past for you, but I mean, it's not like Gracie is in college now, is she?
No, she's not. Some days it feels like you'll wake up the next morning and that much time will have gone by overnight. But no, she will be a sophomore in high school.
Okay.
Come September.
All right. Good to know time's not flashing that fast by us.
Yeah.
Yeah. You describe holding your daughter, Gracie, for the first time in the hospital after delivery. That triggered your sense of smell. What do you remember about that moment?
I remember the kind of intense, all-consuming bond that just springs to life when you hold your child. I think that's a universal feeling. Virtually every parent who's met their child in that moment, even mothers who've been carrying around this little being unknown to them until that moment, have that rush of feeling that accompanies the meeting. You know you're carrying a child, you don't know exactly who, even if you know the gender or you have the sense of their personality from how active they are, you don't know really who's there. And so that moment of meeting is, I think, very profound. And, you know, as we've moved into a very medical model for birth, which is saving lives and hugely important, I think we've also forgotten some of the quietness and the sacredness of that moment that used to accompany it in more traditional birthing traditions. So I'm glad to see some of the dim lights, the quieter calm that has crept back into some delivery room even within hospital settings.
Mm-hmm. We had a discussion last week with a guest who talked about the medicalization of pregnancy, and she was not the first. But I mean, the fact is that medical authorities are certainly important here. What was the first indication after Gracie was born that she was not entirely healthy?
Well, the first indication was really almost a passing concern expressed by, I think, the midwife and also some nurses, that she looked a little yellow. And, you know, many babies are jaundiced at birth or right after birth, and that's usually a passing thing. And we kind of brushed those concerns aside and said, you know, my mom is Greek. We have this Mediterranean strain. I think my mom said we're all yellow. But then later in the... I was still in the hospital, you know, just recovering from the birth, and later in that day, actually deep in the sort of nighttime hours, one of the hospitalists, who was actually the head of neonatal medicine there, came on duty, and he looked at her and sort of instantly went, wait a minute, this kid is really in crisis, actually, and ran all of the tests again and saw that her hemoglobin was quite low and her bilirubin, which is a measure of the broken down red cells in your blood, was quite high. And that was when everybody got very mobilized, and it was, you know, get up, get dressed, get in the ambulance, you're going to a bigger, better hospital. And was really the beginning of her medical crisis.
Is there even a name for what Gracie was born with?
Well, what she ultimately lived with as an infant and a toddler was a transfusion-dependent anemia. So she was incapable of holding on to her red cells. She would produce them and they would fall apart. And that caused two kinds of problems. For one, if you don't have red cells, you're not getting enough oxygen, because that's the oxygen delivery system for the body. And secondly, if your red cells are falling apart, there's a debris of iron that floats around in the blood. And when she was a tiny infant, that was a real danger. The iron level in her blood was getting so high, or there was so much bilirubin in her blood, that they thought they might have to do what they call an exchange transfusion, where they take all the blood out of the body, clean it, and return it back into circulation.
Did you really crack a joke about whether she was going to get rust in the brain with the iron in her blood?
I did call it rust head. When somebody's explaining things to you that just don't make any sense, that sound ludicrous, the way medical problems often do sound ludicrous, I think you fall back on trying to see that big picture absurdity, even while in the immediate moment you're terrified, and wanting to figure out exactly what to do to help your kid ASAP.
Well, it didn't exactly happen ASAP, but it did happen over time, which is the reason that the book is called Happiness, The Crooked Little Road to Semi Ever After. We are going to meet more of Heather Harpum's family when we come back from this break on the Jefferson Exchange. You can join us by phone or by email. We'll come back in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Heather Harpum, playwright, essayist, fiction writer, solo performance artist. She wrote a book about her own experiences with her child, who was very sick when she was born. That's her child, Gracie. And it was a very complicating factor because of the fact that Heather had a relationship with a person who didn't want to have children. And off we go into a really interesting realm of twists and turns. The book is called Happiness, The Crooked Little Road to Semi-Ever After. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. So we've talked just about Gracie thus far, which is actually how the book is constructed. We meet her first, and then we meet Gracie's father. And you take us to your first date with him, and he talked about happiness in a way that I don't know, it's really interesting.
Yeah, he did. He brought up to me an article he'd read about people's happiness quotient, and said that the article was positing that people have an essential happiness set point, that sort of the way we move through the world and the way we feel is essentially regulated at a certain level, and that even when we experience real highs or lows in circumstance, we'll sort of eventually settle back at that same state of happiness, which is sort of our own innately. I have no idea if that's real or not, but I was intrigued, and certainly the beginning of our courtship had this moment of acknowledgement that we have a different kind of way of moving through the world.
Well, opposites attract, as you point out. How opposite were you and Brian?
We were and we are. We're super very opposite, and somehow that works. As I think lots of people who are very different from their spouse know, there's a kind of balancing that can happen. That said, there were real and deep conflicts in regards to how we saw making a meaningful adult life. And for me, that picture always included a family with children, and for Brian, it did not. He was, and he is deeply dedicated to writing and to living that life in which you're engaged in a very profound way with your artistic projects or creative life. And he thought for a long time that having a family and being a writer or being an artist were antithetical. And maybe they are in some final analysis, but a lot of us find a way to walk the middle ground.
Well, in fact, he had said in therapy, if he wanted to have kids, it'd be with you. So there was the big if in there. And then how long had you been together when you discovered you were pregnant?
Not very long, about a year, a little over a year. So, in fact, our relationship was new in many regards, and we weren't living together you know, we were very much in love. In the realm of feeling, there was, I think, an intensity and a shared bond. But we were actively and constantly talking about this difference in the way we saw our future. Even for a couple who'd only been together for a year, to be talking so much about the difference in the way they imagined their future is a little bit unusual, and I think a mark of the fact that we were trying to figure out a future together. But that really, that ability to even talk it out came to a rupture when I got pregnant, and it had to be decided now. You know, pregnancy is, if nothing else, a clock, and you're on it.
there's no pushing that deadline past.
That's right.
Was he even willing to think about it, to entertain the idea of being a parent with you?
He was, of course, but I think that what happened was that, you know, we both did precisely what we had told one another we would do if an unexpected pregnancy occurred. And I had said very clearly that I would, as much as I support people's right to choose individually for themselves how to handle an unexpected pregnancy, that I myself would embrace it, and that any pregnancy that came along would God willing and you know, health willing, result in a baby. And Brian had said that he wasn't choosing to parent in this life, but that was the decision he'd made. So we each did just what we said we would do, but I think we surprised each other. Yeah. And more than that, I think, you know, it's one thing to talk about things in the abstract, and it's another to talk about it when it's really happening. And it's difficult. It sort of pushes everybody to their most reactionary rather than flexibly responsive. And so I simply sort of at some point just went back to California, where I knew I had a base of support and knew I could very luckily, very happily live right beside my mom in a studio that she had adjacent to her house. And I had very dear childhood friends. And not everybody has that. I mean, I felt incredibly lucky to have a base of support to return to do what I thought was going to be single parenting. And what I didn't yet know was going to be at least temporary single parenting of a really sick child.
Her sick child is Gracie. We're talking to Heather Harpum about her twists and turns with her family and relationships. Their book is called Happiness, a Memoir, The Crooked Little Road to Semi-Ever After. And I want to ask about, so Brian asked for his keys back. So, boy, the relationship is pretty much over. You're in California. You have Gracie. She's very sick. You mentioned going in an ambulance to a bigger, more comprehensive hospital. But you did get to take Gracie home to the studio and have some real brand-new baby time with her. How long did that last?
Well, that lasted, I mean, once we were released from the NICU, the neonatal intensive care unit, where we spent about a week, we were home often for, you know, stretches of weeks at a time, and that would be punctuated with the need to give her a blood transfusion. And that procedure is really only like 24 hours in the hospital. And then we'd be back home again. So she had this, you know, tremendous need and this real frailty. She could not survive without transfusions. But in between them, as long as she got her blood, she was a gurgling, pink, normal, delightful, developing infant. And we were at home together. And when we weren't getting blood. Yeah.
When you weren't getting blood, right. So how much, I mean, had you stayed in touch with Brian? Had you decided that you weren't going to tell him any of the details of her birth? He wasn't going to be involved in her life, was what he was thinking at the time. So did you tell him about her condition or any of that?
I felt that the question of how involved he would be in her life was entirely open-ended. It was clear that we were separating while I was pregnant. And it was clear that I was going to have the baby and I was going back to California. Brian would stay in New York. But whether or not you're involved in your child's life is not a question you decide in 1 minute. You know, it's decided, in some senses, how we parent, how well we parent is decided every day, moment by moment by moment by moment. And I felt that that was an entirely open question and that Brian would know more how he felt over time and particularly after he met his daughter.
And so he did make plans to meet her.
He did, and he was extremely connected and in, you know, almost constant contact with us from the time she was born. And so we began to talk, and he then made plans to see her. Yeah,
she's about 4 months old at the time, and so how did that go for you? I mean, what were the conversations like? You write in the book that you got to the point where you were so focused on her, you weren't really feeling much of anything for him. But I mean, what was it like to have this union of father and daughter and you?
It was incredibly moving. I mean, it was very hard because there was this history, and you know, there was as you can imagine, a very complicated confluence of feelings. But more than whatever Brian had been to me, with me, and whatever I had been to him or with him, there was now a third person, and she's his child, he's her father. You know, you get one biological, most of us, I mean, it's a whole new world, who knows what's coming, but until now, you've had one, you know, biological mom and one biological dad, and that's an irreplaceable connection. It has meaning in a very particular way.
And I can say that
it did for us. I mean, as soon as I say that, I'm thinking about kids who are adopted or don't know their biological parent, and their connection is entirely complete and fulfilled with an adoptive parent. So who knows what meaning is what you generate between two people. But for Brian, knowing he had a daughter in the world, I knew that question was going to be open for him, how much he would be in her life. And in fact, when he met her, the description that he's used is, Gracie kicked down the door and all my love for you and for her came flooding through. You know, babies can be a mighty, mighty force, and she certainly was.
Well, and it certainly comes across in the book. I mean, that portion of the book when you're all together for the first time is the oxytocin practically oozes off the pages at us. I think we all get the bonding hormone from reading it. The book is called Happiness, The Crooked Little Road to Semi-Ever After. Heather Harpam, the author, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange today. She's actually talking to us from the San Francisco area. We should be talking at the book passage in the Ferry Building Marketplace this afternoon or evening if you're in the Mendocino, one of the listeners in the southern end of our viewing area, you might actually get down there. But we're going to talk to her right now a little more, and you can join us at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So take us back a bit further in time to your childhood with your mom. It sounds like it was never particularly dull.
No, it certainly wasn't dull. My mom is extremely fun-loving and forward-moving, and I have a tremendous amount of respect for the life that she carved out for herself. You know, she came from she was the child of first-generation Greek immigrants who came here and were very motivated to be successful and to enact an idea of an American success story. And they did that. My grandfather had a business. He had an insurance agency, and they did very well. But my mother grew up in a very codified world. There were ways of acting. There were right and there were wrong, and you were meant to be, you know, to fulfill an image and sort of, you know, maybe on the edge of a sort of aspirationally debutante, maybe, if you would say it, sort of from an immigrant perspective. And she went off to have a life that actually had real meaning for her and value. I have incredible respect for the fact that she, you know, had a child young. She had me at 21, also an unexpected pregnancy. She was committed to having the baby. She and my dad got married. And then she completed school, which wasn't easy because her parents were much less supportive when she sort of went away from what they had imagined she would do or be. But she finished college, and then she was devoted to getting a graduate degree, and she did that and really fell in love with sociology and made a life for herself. It was a sort of peripatetic life, a life with a lot of movement in it, but a life with meaning at the center, meaningful work, and a devotion to raising her kid well.
And quite a rotating cast of characters through your childhood, though, it sounds like.
Yes, there were. You know, it was California. It was the 1970s. But my mom didn't rotate. She was the fixed planet in my universe, and I knew I could depend on her. She was a very loving parent. You know, ultimately, my family became quite complicated because both of my parents remarried. They remarried people who already had children, and then they had children with those people. So it's a true kind of California blended family, to put it mildly.
So lots of step-siblings and half-siblings and all
that's
that.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. I have two brothers on my mom's side who are now adults. One has a child of his own, but I'm almost a generation older than them, so I kind of got to half-parent them, half-be their sister. Mm-hmm. And my dad has a daughter. So it was complicated, but like I said, my mom was the constant within that, and a very loving parent.
What did either you or Brian think about ways in which your motherhood might have been echoing how your mother raised you?
I think Brian thought about it consciously more than I did. I mean, I write in the book that he, you know, accused, might have been the word I used in the book, and it might be too strong of a word, but he certainly suggested, if you will, to me that I might be unconsciously recreating a scenario in which I would be the single parent to an only child, because that's what I knew, that's what I grew up with, and that, you know, that my sense of fathers were that they were semi-absent or not fully reliable, or and that I'd sort of reenacted that without intending to consciously, maybe, but you know, that wasn't a very popular idea with me when he put it forward.
Can imagine.
Because it sounded like a way to explain his own choices. But when I really paused to reflect on it, I thought that I thought and I think that there was something to that. We all of us have that capacity to recreate parts of our childhood, that even the parts that didn't work well,
right,
they're familiar, right? And we generate that. Here's that story. I know that story. I'm gonna rewrite this story one more time. Happily, incredibly happily, both Brian and I were able to make a choice to do things differently. And for me, it meant not being that autonomous single mom, but actually trying to figure out how to have a true partnership. And for Brian, it meant living life in a way that was radically different than he imagined he could. And, you know, every day we're still at it.
Mm-hmm.
It's never a finished product, but it's sure a gift.
Heather, how intentional was it all? I mean, how much did you just sort of let things happen, like, gee, I still seem to be here and my toothbrush is now here, versus, you know, talking each step before it happened?
Do you mean when we were reconciling?
Yes.
When Grace was already born? Oh, it was quite intentional. And it happened really pretty quickly. I mean, I shared with you that image Brian shared with me about Gracie kicking down the door,
right,
sort of his defense. And I mean, we both were wary, and it takes time. You know, I think the act of forgiveness is really easy to talk about in pat terms, and really, really hard to do. And I don't think it happens overnight. And for us, the forgiveness, on the surface of the story, it might just seem like it would flow in one direction. But, you know, I really hurt Brian in ways as well. And that forgiveness needed to flow in both directions. And I think a huge part of it is the ability, even when it's difficult, to be curious about the other person's experience. You know, how did I hurt you, and what was it like for you? And please tell me, I want to know. And, you know, then to be willing to let go. And those things just don't happen overnight. So our intention to create a family together surfaced again strongly, and it was intentional. It wasn't just like, hey, leave your toothbrush here. I mean, Brian was coming all the way from New York to California. And then we made the decision together that he was going to take a sabbatical and move to California to see how things were. So everything was quite by design, but it didn't happen overnight. Took time. And we didn't even, you know, we waited to get married until we were deep into things and our kids were 3 and 5.
All right, so we'll get to the fact that there are now 2 kids, and things have moved along a little bit since that time. The book is called Happiness, The Crooked Little Road to Semi-Ever After, and we'll talk more with Heather Harpham about the details of her life as they relate in the book. And if you'd like to join us, we'll take some phone calls and emails from you as well. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is Heather Harpham. She's a playwright, essayist, fiction writer, solo performance artist, and now memoirist with her book, it's called Happiness, The Crooked Little Road to Semi-Ever After. Heather was in a loving relationship with a man who did not want children. She got pregnant. They parted. She had the child. The child was sick. The man wanted to see her, and well, things have gotten better along the way. We'll talk more about how. You can join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. So Gracie had this form of anemia that required constant transfusions. And then, bam, a doctor asks you if you thought of having another child. Why?
Because a second child could become, if they matched Gracie, a potential donor for a bone marrow transplant.
And that would be a cure.
That would be a cure. You know, we never got a clear diagnosis as to why her body couldn't hold on to its red blood cells. And we saw doctors literally all over the country. But finally, her primary doctor at UCSF said to us, listen, if you take out the entire engine and replace it, the car will run. Like, it doesn't really matter if it's the carburetor or the timing belt or the transmission. You know, we're just going to take out everything and put it back in. And that everything, in essence, was her bone marrow, which is where all red cells and white cells and platelets are produced. So it's quite a radical solution, and that bone marrow transplant carries a mortality risk, especially pediatric bone marrow transplant. And it was a difficult decision to make, but we, you know, the decision about whether or not to have a transplant was one decision, and the decision whether or not to have a child in hopes of them being a match for Gracie was another decision.
Okay, so two decisions.
But first,
let's talk about the wobble thrown into your universe by this, just the question the doctor was asking, and holding out the possibility of a cure.
Yeah, and it was thrilling and disorienting in that we hadn't considered having a second child. As you can well imagine, when you have one sick child, the last thing you want is another sick child.
Right.
And because we didn't have a diagnosis for Gracie, they couldn't give us odds on whether or not our new child would be born sick. A second child would carry the same disorder. So we made the decision clearly and firmly not to have a second child. But clearly we are people who whose will is not always enacted in the realm of pregnancy and unexpected children.
Right, so. because it happened again. And so even before you got to that point, though, I mean, how much did you and Brian must have talked for hours, if not weeks, about the ethics of a cure child?
I'll be honest with you. We talked for hours about, and days, about our own tolerance for the possibility of having another baby who'd be born sick. We didn't talk extensively about the ethics of having, as you put it, a cure child, because we came to the conclusion before that we couldn't risk having another sick baby. So, you know, we did think about those ethics, but not in the way that is kind of paralyzing for some parents who know they're going to have a well child and are trying to decide whether or not to bring a child into the world with the first motivation being to save another of their child, or to save that child's sibling. So I don't envy parents who have to think along those lines. That's an excruciating position to be in. It's excruciating to have a child whose life hangs in the balance, mm-hmm. and then to try and make decisions about how to grow your family in response to that danger is all the more excruciating. We didn't go all the way there because we just couldn't imagine having another sick baby. But I certainly encountered families in our time on the transplant unit who did have to think those questions through.
I'm amazed at the level of tenacity that the being that became Gabriel showed.
I mean, I think you can leave it at that, Jeffrey. he was determined to make his way into the world, we shall say, and he did.
And he did indeed. I thought that, you know, once you discovered you were pregnant again, I thought the next paragraph would be about Brian throwing socks and undies in a suitcase, but no.
Oh, my gosh, no. It was quite the opposite. When we discovered that second pregnancy, I was, you know, really scared about whether Gabriel, not yet known to be Gabriel, would be healthy, and just what it meant to have the prospect of having two small children under 2 years old at the same time, one of whom was very sick, at least one. And, you know, Brian and I were still figuring out how to form a family and a partnership, and this certainly felt like, well, that question is answered for the foreseeable future. So I felt quite worried. I felt, you know, sort of anxious about all of those open questions. And Brian, at least in that first blush of knowing, met it with the kind of unmitigated joy that is the best, you know, when you can get there. That's what you hope you can greet every pregnancy with.
So it was pretty much exactly the opposite of how he greeted the first pregnancy.
That's right. We flipped poles, as it were.
So along comes Gabe, and how did he look at birth? I mean, you talked about how Gracie looked when she was born. She mm-hmm. looked a little yellow and jaundiced and that sort of thing. Yeah. How did Gabe look by comparison?
Gabe looked great. He looked just stupendous. He was, you know, pink, and he had these huge lips. We called him Mick Jagger. He was healthy. He was, you know, the picture of a healthy, very active, energetic baby that has turned into the active, energetic boy/young man that he is now. So, yeah, it was a true joy to greet a child who was healthy and unattended by those worries that came in with Gracie. He was just a joy.
And a perfect match for Gracie, as it turned out. So obviously the bone marrow transplant was, you know, would do everything you thought it did. How old was Gracie? How old were the two of them when the procedure was done, and how quickly did you notice a change in Gracie's health?
Well, the first thing I'll say is that one thing Brian and I were incredibly grateful for, and this goes back to your question about parents who wrestle over the issue of whether or not to have a cure child, is that we did not have to touch Gabriel in order to get his stem cells, which are what we used to give Gracie a bone marrow transplant. So Gabriel's stem cells were umbilical cord blood cells, and they were extracted from the cord, the umbilical cord itself. So Gabriel didn't have to undergo any medical trauma.
Not even a needle, it sounds like.
No, not even a needle. Nothing touched his person in order to give this gift to his sister, which really did feel miraculous.
Mm-hmm.
We had to wait several months to find out whether or not he was a match for her, and incredibly, wonderfully, he was. And then we had to go through the process of deciding when and whether to go through transplant. And that took us time because of the enormous risks that transplant carried. And so it wasn't until Gracie was 3 and a half that we actually went to Duke Medical Center in Durham, North Carolina, to begin the transplant process. And we were there for 10 months, almost a whole year.
Wow.
So it took a long time.
Is this the process that I remember years ago, bone marrow transplants used to be basically killing off all the old bone marrow in the patient and then replacing it. Is that still the process that's done?
That is exactly right. You hollow out the bones. I think at one point in the book I refer to Gracie as a straw girl, like a straw man.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you literally hollow out the bones, and that's the difficult part. You have to eradicate the original bone marrow, which has the defect in it. And in order to do that, you have to hit the body with massive waves of chemotherapy. It's been described in other places I've read it described as carpet bombing the body with chemotherapy. So instead of the kind of chemo treatment that you would get for cancer, which is, you know, maybe the same amount over a long, much longer period of time, you're giving a very high dose in a very short period of time to kill off all the marrow.
So before
and
she...
then, mm-hmm. yeah, you're giving the new donation and praying like hell that it engrafts, or heck, if you will, because, you know, when you transplant a heart, you've got the new heart sitting beside you in the operating room, or the new lungs, or the new kidney.
You just hook them
with
up.
With bone marrow. Yeah, it's not, you don't have this physical organ. You're transplanting cells, and you need them to grow. So that was a critical period as well.
So you must have gone through a period when Gracie was relatively healthy before all this set of procedures, and then with the chemotherapy, probably looked awful for a while.
That's exactly right, and it's one of the things that made it so difficult to take her to transplant. We'd actually already made the decision, and we'd moved there to Durham to do this, or half moved, because Brian needed, of course, to keep working in New York. But even once we got there, it was tremendously hard to go through with it because she looked and seemed like a healthy little three-year-old girl, delightful, you know, toddler curls and chubby knees and, you know, smiles and giggles. We knew she had this deeply embedded problem that she couldn't really survive and have a healthy life with, but she looked and seemed very much like a thriving three-year-old, and to take her and put her through that was really hard.
Well, we should point out once again to people who are listening with rapt attention, the book is called Happiness.
She did come out the other side, yeah.
So I read and mentioned at the beginning of the broadcast that you have done this as a stage show also called Happiness. I mean, it's obviously so moving and so many highs and lows. I mean, how did you keep it together when A, writing it, and B, rehearsing it, and C, performing it?
That's such a thoughtful question. Thank you. Well, I didn't want to write a piece about this because I really didn't want to think about it anymore, but as anybody who's got a creative life knows, you don't always get to decide your material. Some things just intrude. And this was something that just kept surfacing. It was hard. It was hard to make the show, and in all honesty, it was hard to perform it. I don't perform it anymore for precisely this reason. The show is quite different. I mean, the show, I hope, has humor in it. I tried to leaven it. I did think a lot about the audience, and it was important to me that the show not be more than anyone could take, that there be a balance between, for lack of better words, but, you know, light and dark, a sense of heaviness and a sense of levity. The show is different from the book in that it really doesn't talk about Brian and I's relationship at all, and it does talk much more about, in particular, one other family we knew who lost their child, and even in the voice of that child herself, I take on that character. And it tries to wrestle the piece with some of the philosophical questions that arise when you've watched innocents suffer and are asking, why? Why? And I don't think those questions have answers. Or they don't for me. For some of us, we have a religious tradition or paradigm that does answer them. I certainly feel feel a very strong spiritual impulse. I'm astonished by the world whenever I slow down enough to really take it in. But I don't know why innocents suffer, and I tried to simply express our gratitude for our luck and our grief at watching the other children who were lost through the performance piece. I hope some of that is there in the book, but it's definitely there in the piece, and it made it hard to keep doing.
I heard your interview with Robin Young on Here and Now yesterday on this very same station, and she talked about gripping the book, and once I got into it, I fully understood. It's quite moving on a number of levels. It's called Happiness, The Crooked Little Road to Semi-Ever After. Heather Harpum wrote it. She'll be at Copperfield's Books in San Rafael today and San Francisco later in the day at the Book Passage in the Ferry Building Marketplace and at Powell's City of Books in Portland tomorrow. Heather, a pleasure. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
All right, take care.